Hello, and welcome to The Wander. My name is Andrew Charles Wilcox. I'm glad you could join me today, and I'm really excited for today's guest. His name is Blake Berglund. He is, well, many things. He's a musician. He's a creator. He's a writer. He's a farm boy. He is a thinker, and as he would describe it, a seeker, which I think is a great term to use. That's kind of the point of this podcast, is to talk to seekers, people who wander into the unknown to learn more and to share that knowledge with us. I'm going to not talk a ton during this intro, even though it's been a while, because him and I spoke for about 2.5 hours in total. I edited it a little bit just to get it down. Plus, my dogs popped in a couple of times and I had to edit that out. But it was a really great conversation. It was an absolute joy to speak to him. And I found by the end of it, he was so good at talking that I probably talked more than I wanted to or should have. But it was a really fun time. It was a really enjoyable conversation. And it is the longest podcast I've done so far, almost 2 hours. So settle in, hang out, and enjoy my conversation with Blake Berglund.
Let's get into the history. What brought you to the place that you are now? Where did it all start? First,
where it all started. I guess it started with piano lessons when I was 3 years old.
Yeah,
and that was more coloring than piano playing. But that was sort of an indication of how early the musical push would be for me from my parents. It was a big musical push.
Yeah. Did you have a big musical family?
No, not at all. My mom bought a piano when she was pregnant with me. My dad, he played air piano. And other than that, my grandfather played the piano and he played the mouth organ, the harmonica. So there was a little bit of music in there somewhere. He kind of faked it all the way through. Like he could quote unquote play the fiddle, but I think there was just more dancing and smiling than actually fiddle playing. And then mom took lessons when she was pregnant with me. And then I started when I was just a little guy. I was always jumping up on the bench and she just put me in early and I stayed with it. I went through sort of the Royal Conservatory and I got my grade 10 piano when I was in, I think when I was 16, when I was still in high school. And two in theory. And that was kind of the basis I needed to just sort of jump forward musically. Obviously, that's a substantial amount of piano playing in one's life. And it came very early.
Yeah, yeah.
So a lot of my development as a human was alongside my development as a musician, which I found was always a really neat parallel.
And where did you grow up?
Kennedy.
Where's that?
2 hours southeast of Regina on the 48 highway. The corner kind of the 48 and the number 9 highway. Number 9 runs north and south between Whitewood and Kenosi Lake. Our land kind of backs onto the park, the Moose Mountain Provincial Park. So when I, you know, the lore of Blake Berglund in my bio and everything says I'm from the Moose Mountains, and I am from the Moose Mountains, but they aren't really mountains, but they're pretty big hills down in this southeast corner. And, you know, I turned 18 and, or I guess I was a little younger than that, probably 16. And wanted to learn how to play the guitar. And there was noon hour guitar lessons at school. And I signed up for those. And then I just started writing. As soon as I could sort of have that foundation with the piano and the guitar, I just started writing. About 17 years old, started writing songs. And I have been writing songs since I was 17. It's not hyperbole to say every day, but that's what I do, you know?
Since
I was 17, just write a ton of songs.
But you took a roundabout way to get back to Regina and to country music, I think, as well.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's kind of our foundations. Where we met was in Alberta.
In Alberta, and you were a rock star.
And I was never doing, I never did, I never, I listened to country music. We were listening to just AM radio country music growing up. But it was never something that I thought, oh, this is what I'm gonna.
What did you guys farm?
Mixed. Yeah, Dad always had cattle always had cereal grain and oil and oilseed and just a mixed kind of.
Yeah, yeah.
He had an entrepreneurial spirit. He was sort of he would get gigs in the oil patch and clearing leases and I think that became
the requirement of a farm at one point.
Yeah.
Like, how much land did you guys have? Or do you guys have?
It was a few thousand acres, okay. I believe, is what my dad managed and has expanded on that since my brother and my sister have taken it over. But yeah, farming's a crazy commitment. There's crazy parallels as well between farming and what I've always done. It's growing up in that lifestyle, you know, the rural, growing up in rural Saskatchewan has totally influenced my approach to life, my approach to my music, my approach to my business.
Well, I think that you and I have several parallels when it comes to that. Mm-hmm. So I grew up in a quarter section just outside of Camrose, Alberta. Mm-hmm. We were mixed farms. We were dairy till 1986. 86 to 89, we were strictly grains. Mm-hmm. And then 89 on, we were purebred Angus. And then we also had some grain farming in there. And then like in the 90s, late 90s especially, my dad had the quarter section, but he was farming other lands. Those lands got sold off because the farmers the people who owned them had just decided to retire, and they sold them off. And they sold them off to other farms. And so my dad kind of scaled back and went to just doing some cattle for a while and then retired in 2005 himself. Mm-hmm. So, and I get that. Like, I had the piano lessons when I was probably 8.
So we're right parallel.
I had the piano lessons when the only thing that changes this is I am not musically talented much at all, and you are incredible at it. But I wasn't very good at the piano lessons. And I actually kind of quit them after about a year, I think it was. And then my sister wanted piano lessons when she was she would have been 12, because I was 14 or 15. And I said, if she's getting music lessons, then I get music lessons, but I want guitar. Mm-hmm. And so I had a guitar teacher, and I had to go to this guy's basement in Camrose, Alberta. And like, I don't know what it was, if he just saw that I wasn't like technically inclined to it at all, but he was just like, look, he's like, you bring me in a CD, I will listen to it, I will figure out how to play it, and I will show you how to play those songs. And that was really what I know on guitar, and that's really my level.
But I still play.
I still plug away. I still, you know, cover songs and stuff like that. But I've never really been in a band. It's never been the path for me. I've always just kind of loved the conversation more.
Baby.
But
yet.
You never know. I'm just waiting for my voice to get to the Tom Waits, like late Johnny Cash level. And then maybe we'll put some songs together. But long story short, I understand the connection between working on the farm and being on the farm and how that directs and changes your life moving forward.
Oh yeah, and it's as positive as it is influencing, and I don't want to say negative, but like there's a culture of burnout, in that world, and there's no choice, like burnout or bust. Like you don't take a break from farming to recover from a difficult harvest. No. You're into the next thing, right? And I mean, maybe harvest is a bad example because that kind of is the end to a certain extent, but from haying comes in harvesting. If you're burnt out, well, it's just, you go.
You just keep going.
It's just cool. And that was my approach to my music. Like for the last 25 years, it's like, well, this is what I do. And shows are shows. And I'm burnt out. Mm. And it's like, all right, but let's keep going. And it's, you know, the universe delivers what it needs to deliver. And I remember thinking the end of 2019, I was like, I'm burnt out. I legitimately faced it. I was like, wow, I'm burnt out. I've done 52, 75, 80 shows a year for almost 15, 20 years kind of thing.
But I think, I think an important part of that is you get burned out, but you don't really talk about it. Like you just go. Like, I think there's a lot in farm families and rural families where, especially, I don't know about for you when you were growing up, but for me when I was growing up, there definitely wasn't mental health conversations. And we're close to the same age.
Yep.
There definitely wasn't a lot of mental health conversations when I was younger. I know my dad was burned out for a long time. I'm grateful that he never took it out on us kids, but we could see it. Mm-hmm. There was a time, as I was kind of mentioning earlier, where the farm wasn't everything to sustain the family. So you had to take second jobs. My dad's been an operator, machinery operator for years. He was a truck driver. He was a school bus driver. He did all of that stuff to make sure everything that he needed to do to get the family through. But he also had that incredible love for taking care of animals that he could never let go of. Mm-hmm. But he It took him a long time to talk about the mental aspects of it all. And he came to it probably in his 60s.
Yeah.
And I think that we come to it a little bit earlier. You know, I think we're having a better time at it a little bit earlier. So if you're coming to it, was that the moment that hit you in 2019?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've always kind of been in tune with my feelings growing up. So I could recognize, things within myself. You know, so I wouldn't say it's the first time I felt the burnout, but it was the first time that I was like, oh, I got to deal with this.
Yeah.
And then there's kind of the irony. It was the end of 2019. I was like, okay, well, I'm just going to take the winter. I'm going to get back at it in the spring of 2020. I'm going to go hard again. And come March 2020, I was like, all right, let's go, baby. And then boom, it was like, everything shut down. So I was like, okay, maybe I wasn't as healed up as I needed to be from burnout. And it's taken until months ago.
Yeah.
To be like, okay, this is what I'm good at. And this is what I do. And I got a record in my back pocket and I'm like, there's the steps that need to be taken to put this thing out in the world. And it's only a couple months ago where I was like, all right, I'm not burnt out anymore. You know, there's other things that, you know, I kind of got to fight through, like crazy things have happened in life since the pandemic. And it's also it's almost too milestone-y, like not to jump straight into the meat and potatoes, but like pandemic, radical shift of career. And then I have a little boy and my first son, and then my best friend with my uncle passes away. And then I turn 40 years old and then my dad dies. And then it's like in 2 years, it's just upends. It's just, my mind's like Swiss cheese right now. Yeah. And it's also given this perspective to be like, not to be vulgar and say shit or get off the pot, but it's like, and it's cheesy to say this, but there's a life to live. This is life. Life is grief and joy. It is and it's not even a balance. It's those two emotions, and everything kind of funnels towards one or the other. And that's where I'm going to jump back on my saddle and head out into the world with a guitar and kick some ass in some venues is in this headspace of grief and joy.
And there's a time limit on it. And we don't know what that time limit is.
Time limit to
what? To life.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, exactly.
There's a time limit to life, and we don't know what that is. Yeah. We have no idea.
Yeah.
And yeah, and one of the ways, so I was looking, and I have been a subscriber to your, do they call them blogs now? Substack?
Yeah, Substack, I guess. Yeah. Substack has become its own
I know.
Noun, it's a blog, yeah.
It's
blog. I call it my blog.
Yeah.
I call it my Substack. It's, you know.
But has that been an outlet for you to deal with a lot of this that you've gone through? Because I've seen you're speaking a lot.
Dude, that has been my only outlet.
Yeah.
Like, and it is just, that's where I have kind of funneled all my creative insight and I don't want this struggle to be, this sounds, I don't care how it sounds. I don't want it to be in vain. Like, I don't want it to be in vain to myself. I don't want to not develop through a period of grief, and I don't want to be stagnant in my who I am as a man. I want to be fluid in like in my development, and grief is one of those, could you say, an alchemizer? Like, it just changes everything. And I think a lot, not to jump around with thoughts, and I do jump around with thoughts a lot. If you listen to my check-in on the bases on the subs, I'm jumping all over the place.
This is called The Wander for that reason too, man.
Yeah.
You can go anywhere.
But it's important. I have a gift with words because I've developed a gift with words, and I think it's important to, and God's given me that gift of words, that I use it just to be honest with my own experience. So somebody else that is having difficulty being honest with their experience can maybe see some parallels and be like, oh, this is what vulnerability is, because it's a very vulnerable Substack. And I think that vulnerability is a really wonderful contagion. I think that when you experience someone else's vulnerability, it kind of gives you a healthy little shake in your heart. And it feels like a real safe bet, even though it's never a safe bet to be vulnerable, because it's so difficult. But someone else is going to read something that I wrote about, you know, my freaking feelings, and they're going to be like, oh yeah, that connects with me. And then, and I think that's why I am writing the way I am right now in that format, in the prose. And you know, I don't want to be too somber of a tone.
It's all good.
Monday mornings, you get an email. It's like, oh God, it's something about grief. But, and it isn't always, I've been trying to tell more of a greater spanning story that leads into this new record. And it's come through a handful of different series. But yeah, I like the outlet. Mm-hmm. I like the discipline. I like having to sit my ass in a chair. And if nothing is written, those are the steps that needed to be taken in that 2 hours to get to what needs to be written. And I read a lot about writing, which is a strange thing. My buddy Dal Barber says, you got to do shit in life because no one wants to hear songs about writing songs. And I find that's very true.
It's very
true. You have to do stuff in life to be a songwriter. But to be a writer, you obviously have to write about, you know, experiences. Yeah. And the greater the experiences, the better the writing. But I like to read books about writing, which is weird, and just like understand the grammar and obsess over it and then kind of like see it poetically and see it lyrical and see it as, I like run on sentences. And it's almost like this, it's wrong, quote unquote wrong, the style that I write a lot. But it also feels really conversational and like just a new kind of, I don't know. It's, I like the medium right now. I'm attracted to it.
I don't know where it came from, but I was watching something or listening to it. It might have been a TikTok or something. And they were talking about Bob Dylan and Leonard Cohen. And Bob Dylan was talking about how he wrote, you know, like one of his biggest songs in an hour or 2 hours. And Leonard Cohen would, you know, work every song for days, weeks, months, years. Some songs would take 7 to 10 years
for sure
to just work the for sort sure. of mechanics of those words. He would switch things out. He would change things out. Is that something that you do with your writing? When you say you research all of that part, is that it? Does some of this take?
Oh yeah. Oh well. Days, hours, you know that kind years? Of. It's a nice segue to songwriting. It has influenced my songwriting. My songwriting has become a little more prosy, and my prose has become a little more lyrical. And they don't live in the same world, but the approach to textures and tones and little tips and tricks in writing I like to use in songwriting and vice versa, and a cadence and just a flow of words, how different syllables come out. I listen to a lot of hip hop because they're the masters of it. It's a mastery of using syllables and using cadence and flow and phrasing. And that stuff's super influential in writing a blog post, in writing a paragraph. And then you know, dependent on the topic, a song that's funny is going to have a different cadence and tone than a song that's of a more subdued or sad sort of thing. And the same with prose. It's like there's a different flow in the writing when it is of a lighter tone or of, you know, I like playing with stories of mischief. And I have this series that I wanted to, I might still go into on the Substack, of just like my mischievous younger self, like this assessment as a man now looking back at this mischievous and where it came from. And you know, there's always, everybody has traumas, and I'm a product of that. And this clash with authority that always has attracted me is the clashing with authority. I think is fun to push back. And that's, you know, I kind of want to explore where that came from. And that would have its own textures and tones, you know, and there's this really wonderful stew in my approach to writing these days where, you know, the songwriting is influencing the prose and the prose is influencing the songwriting and the content is the same. And the approach could be like, spoiler alert, the stories I'm telling right now on Substack lead into songs on this new record, but it's this massive 6-part backstory to like one song. And there's a lot of songs. So it's like, there's this content well that I'm sort of pulling from, that it's abundant. And when it's abundant, you know, it's just the duality of life again. It's like I'm going through grief and the creative juices are abundant and the well is overflowing. And it's,
so what's on this new record, is it coming from what everything that's happened in the last,
I've said, it only becomes more real with the passing of time for me on a personal level.
Yeah.
it was finished before, you know, it was be finished. It was finished long before my dad passed.
Yeah.
But there's, my dad has such an influence on the record that the content is now recontextualized to the meaning of the song is the song's the song, mm-hmm. but my interpretation of my own song has changed now because of the passing of the events while sitting on a record. It's the weirdest concept. Yeah, yeah.
Do you think the performances will be different from the recordings because of that?
Yeah. You know, you try and represent the recording as best you can with the tools that you have for the crowd that shows up. And you know how I play a song, and it's always been like this. There's my recorded version, and then there's what I'm working with live in the moments, and they never sound the same. When I have the band that recorded the songs playing with me live, which has happened over and over again in my career, those periods, obviously, it sounds like that recorded version.
Mm-hmm, because
I think that the events that have transpired have just given another filter to look through the songs at, which gives more opportunity to dissect what I want to speak about before I perform the song. You know, you can kind of make a story. Another spoiler. You kind of make a story about every song. There's something in everything that you can expand on and put a hook in and give tension to. And at the end of the ability to tell a story, you got a really compelling story to lead into something. And, you know, since Dad died, I've played in the last 3 months, 4 or 5 shows kind of thing. And they have all been a point in the show where I choke up. But I think that's important for people to hear somebody speak through emotion. And I think when I'm on stage and there's a captivated crowd and I am going through just a quick little moment, or sometimes it's a little bit longer, of getting through that thought, choking up and singing or whatever it may be, because there's a few songs, like I got this one song, Get Off the Table Mabel, The Money's for the Beer. It's a silly tongue-in-cheek kind of Cor Blund-esque sort of tune that I wrote in 2011 or 2012. My dad loved it, right?
Yeah.
So, again, jumping around in stories here, but he was a big part of the Kennedy Rodeo, the Moose Mountain Professional Rodeo. My grandfather was the founder of the rodeo, and Dad turned 70 on July the 3rd, he turned 71 on July the 3rd. He passed on July the 8th, just days after his birthday. Then the next weekend is the funeral, and then the weekend after that's the Kennedy Rodeo. And there was it wasn't a memorial, but I was to play the homecoming concert to kick it all off. So talk about like a recontextualizing of that performance, right? Yeah. Supposed to do it with a band. The band learned their stuff, and my wife Melanie was just like, it just wasn't vibing before we were getting on stage, and I've never fired a band before I stepped on stage. And that night I was just like, boys, I set this one out. Like, I think I just need to go up there with my wife and do what I do best. And it's going to be different than what we rehearsed, and I'm going to wing it. And it's, you know, it's my hometown show week after my dad's funeral, and 700 people, the same 700 people are sitting in the crowd that I saw the weekend before with tears running down my face. So it's like this pretty serious moment. And I played Get Off the Table Mabel, The Money's for the Beer for my dad. And it was just like, I've never played a song about a prurient woman where I was choking up through the whole freaking song. And there's a verse in it literally about him too. It's my old man. He's the wise old whiskey drinking cowboy type. And it talks about him. And so it definitely changed the tone of that show. And it was good. It was good. It was a powerful moment. It was a powerful moment for me. It was a powerful moment for my community. It was, the show was one of the best shows that I literally had ever played. I walked up confident and was in front of my hometown. I thought I was going to be a puddle, and I wasn't a puddle. There was a bit of a shake in my voice when I talked about Dad in the one song, but it was a super powerful moment of really wonderful, like a little, sounds weird to say it was a little gift, but it was this little, like, little gift. And then, like, this sounds weird too, but I gave my dad's eulogy, and it was just, there's just this little gift in it.
Yeah.
It's weird to even think about, but like, I felt confident and I felt like I was called to something, and I delivered, and there's a little gift in that. And it's again, my brain's Swiss cheese, because how can I see the gift in giving your father's eulogy? But there is. and especially with my writing. It was a little gift to my writing and how I approach my writing and how I approach my songs. And it will forever be a filter, just having to write that piece and how I went, what the process was in writing my dad's eulogy, how that process can actually carry over into my songwriting. Mm-hmm. And to dig a little deeper, I guess, in the tunes and dig a little deeper in the blog posts. And that's kind of where, that's where the Substack is at. And that's where the songs are at. It's a little bit of a deeper dig right now.
And then on the other end of all this, you're a father now.
It's the best. Dude.
You're a dad, you got a little guy.
Yeah.
And you've got the complete juxtaposition of life.
Totally. It's my joy. It's my, I hate to say my only joy. Everything is really a chore to, I shouldn't say that, but it's true. Everything's a fucking chore. But my son is just joy. It's just pure element. It's just pure joy. It's the best. He is so smart. It's the best. We do puzzles. We do Ninja Turtle puzzles. We are doing, learning our alphabet. He's two and he knows how to spell cat. He knows how to spell bear and he knows how to spell boat. And it's, and as someone who's just naturally curious, it's just mind bending every moment that they say something that you're like, where did you learn that from? Like, sounds good. It's like, who told you sounds good? What do you mean sounds good? Yeah.
Or but do you see maybe yourself next time. There? But do you see yourself there as well?
Did I what?
Do you see yourself through your son as well?
He looks like me.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I hold him at bedtime, and in the dark, it looks like I'm holding little two-year-old Blake. Yeah. It's a trip. And I love him, and I kiss him, it's what I do. I'm like, oh, I'm just kissing little Blake, too, in this moment. Like, it's just so healing to have a little one. And I don't know, I never thought I'd have kids. I guess it's safer to say I didn't think I was going to have children with my wife.
Okay.
We weren't going to have a family.
Yeah. Yeah. That wasn't
and then
the plan.
Maybe not. Yeah. And then maybe out of nowhere, she was just like, no, we're going to have a family. Yeah. And our family was definitely a gift to me from her. And she's incredible. It's transformed her. It's transformed me. We have a little family. It's, you know, I'm never going to look back on this period of my life and think, man, I wish I played more shows I wish I was touring the States at that period in my life instead of being a dad and being so hyper-present, emotionally hyper-present. Yeah. It's good. And it's hard. Like, we were out for a walk 2 days ago and we were in the park and he just started screaming. And I didn't know why he was screaming. He was clawing at his face and clawing at his mouth. And then my arms were burning. And I don't know. I don't know what happened in the park, but we both went to emergency. And his face was sore. And my arms were sore. My neck was hot. And it's still a mystery. It scared the shit out of me. And that's just being a dad, I guess. That's just fathering. That happens.
Yeah.
That's the fifth or sixth thing that you're like, what the fuck is going on? And that's just being a dad. That's just try and keep your cool. A trip.
Did you get to speak with your father about being a father?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Oh, yeah, my dad and I, you know, just like anybody's dad, it's a fluid and dynamic relationship.
Yeah.
It's the greatest. He's my greatest teacher, period. Yeah. My biggest influence, period. And that's all of it. You know, the good and the bad and the best and the difficult. He's my biggest influence.
Yeah,
and, you know, he, in the latter part of his life, he struggled with different things that, you know, life's a slippery slope. And if he didn't take care of his body, like the best a person could take care of their body. And that's from cigarettes to whatever. And it all contributes. And when my little guy was, we showed, he's such a goofball. We printed off a picture of the ultrasound, and I used to read the footbook when I was a little guy, Dr. Seuss footbook. So I bought a new one, the footbook, and I put the ultrasound in. We went to the farm and I gave my mom the footbook and she's like, you know, what's this kind of thing? And opens it up and there's an ultrasound. And she freaked, right? My dad just couldn't get it. He was just like, is that a picture of you? I was like, no, dad, we're having a kid, man. We're going to have a baby. And it was hilarious. And he's great. They just had a wonderful 2-year deeply affectionate, loving relationship. Okay. And I think that that has to live in my son's heart, in Absolutely. His subconscious for his life. It must.
Absolutely, it will.
And, yeah. you know, I keep, if as long as I keep talking about Grandpa and telling him about Grandpa and showing pictures of him hugging Grandpa, like that's, it's not as good as having Grandpa, mm-hmm. but it's the best that it can be. So, and I think that'll live. You know, they might even remember it. Mm-hmm. You know, he's two. Yeah. They might even have this little seed forever that's like, oh yeah, I had a moment. I remember his face, you know, yeah. and maybe it's real, maybe it's not, but yeah, that was another gift just for that 2 years of him having a grandpa and he has his grandma now and she's just amazing. My mom's just epic. Yeah. She's the best grandma ever. T-shirt standard, like always doing crazy, awesome things with my little guy's three cousins. So there's four of them. So, and he has his cousins down at the ranch and yeah, it's party time.
I found with my parents that when they had grandkids, it kind of came to the realization of this is what it was all about. Like it was a weird thing for them. Like they were like, oh, being parents was great and they loved it, but it was all the hard work and the grandkids were the payoff.
Oh, and you never get to, what I've discovered with that is I never knew this woman. I was like, I never knew grandma. Mm-hmm. Like, I never knew this amazingly. And my mom was fun, yeah. you know, but I didn't see this woman that she is with my son and my nephews. And I get to experience that as a mother now.
Yeah.
That's the version of her that she is as my mom right now, which yeah. is, it's like saving the best for last.
See, for me, it was my dad.
Yeah.
Mom has always been just that incredible country mom that she is. My dad, the grandkids just sort of washed away what the things that he felt like he didn't do in his life, or if there was any sort of, you know, lack of feeling of success when he had grandkids and all of his children were smart enough, successful enough, kind enough people to be good parents. And then his grandkids are good people.
Mm-hmm.
He just was like, this was success looks like. Oh, he's legacy. Like, everything else doesn't matter because the legacy is good.
Yeah.
Like, and it just changed who he was.
Yeah.
And the stress of it all, like he still feels it from time to time, as we all do, but it just is different now for him. And that was, I think, and for him, it as you said, legacy. I think he just goes, okay, I've got that. My legacy is good. You put on a record called Realms. What was the impetus on that?
That's a big story that I haven't even told on my channels yet that I'm working towards. I just had, you know, if we just jump into this realm of it, I just had a rude awakening. I had a harsh spiritual awakening.
Yeah.
And it was insane. Yeah. It was insane. Like, I'd have to divulge everything, and mm-hmm. I don't I'm to give the context, but it just, I kind of actually just say it all on the record. Everything, all the lyrics of the record are pretty literal. Listen to the record, read the lyrics on the booklet, or look at them online, and, like, that's what went down.
Yeah.
There was the veil was lifted. I saw, you know, kind of the architecture to whatever reality is, and a version of reality that was supposed to be presented to me, and that came with like middle of the night apparitions and door frames, and I don't think it was necessarily poltergeist,
mm-hmm.
but it kind of a version, maybe a little bit of entity kind of stuff. And you know, I've always been a seeker, so I've always just kind of poked my nose into all the areas to see what lands, and I guess what I've fucking poke my nose into the, I don't want to say the wrong door, it was the right door, but it was a rude awakening. It was one that I thought, oh, like, this isn't good spiritually.
Yeah.
It
was the door you were supposed to go through,
but it ended up ultimately one. Yeah, it was contact with another entity kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it just shook it all up, because I learned it strengthened my faith.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up Catholic, and I was given a toolbox. I say my Catholic toolbox, and I still actually consider myself Catholic, because the discipline is important to me, and that Catholics are disciplined if they want to be. Mm-hmm. There's an avenue to be disciplined if you want to be a good Catholic, or at least do your best. And there's a lot of the stuff in that religion that, it shaped who I am. And that's just kind of what it is. Also, a myriad of other experiences that are in direct conflict with the Catholic doctrine has broadened my spiritual experience. However, in this moment, you know, I just gave myself, I didn't know what to do other than make a deal. My mom always said, well, hopefully you never have to beg. Like, if you don't believe in God, well, hopefully you never have to beg, because you barter with somebody when shit goes down. Like, you'll barter with somebody or something.
Yeah.
So you can say you don't believe in God, but time will tell, kind of thing.
In the end, you'll ask the universe, and the universe may or may not answer.
And you don't even need to call. Who knows what it is?
Right.
If you're begging, you don't care what it is. And I, in a moment of the most despair in my personal life, I just gave myself to Christ as in desperation. And I was just like, I know, kind of classic, like, don't really know what to do now, but you can have me and I will work for you in whatever fashion you feel I'm supposed to be used in this life. And a textbook, born again, textbook fire in the stomach, textbook fire through my chest, textbook fire through my arms.
Yeah.
It was insane. It was another, and like, I don't know. This whole, was it an episode? Was I losing my mind for 2 weeks? Maybe. Maybe. But the outcome is one that has redefined me and strengthened my spirituality and strengthened my relationship with God and strengthened my relationship with Christ. And I saw shit that I was like, okay, if that's real, this has to be real too.
Yeah.
And for me, it's very, very real. All of it's very, very real for me.
And is that been helpful for you through everything in the last little bit?
The last little bit just shakes it all up again. You know, my dad, like, I saw the flash of light when my dad was passing. It was like a welder's arc. It was like it was like tinfoil in a microwave, just a pop of white, blinding flash. And it wasn't light, and it wasn't fire, and it wasn't. It was its own white thing.
Mm. Boom.
And my two sisters saw it. My sister Casey saw it. My mom saw it. My sister Jody was sleeping. This is hours before he quit breathing. Mm-hmm. This is my dad, unresponsive, in the hospital, off of life support, and his family around him. And at 2 o'clock in the morning, on the day that he passed, there was a massive flash of light. And then I said, we were all kind of shook up and quite saw, and I said, Dad, was that you? And a little point of entry above him shot two things, two fiery kind of white stuff, just out parallel to his body over in the hospital bed. And it came back to a singularity point, sucked back to a little black little. And my other sister woke at that point and saw it. And then it went on the other side behind me in the window. Outside, there was a ball of lightning or of fire or of a ball. And then it continued further and further. And he passed hours after that. Wow. Crazy. So, like, what was that?
Yeah.
You know, like, I couldn't tell that. I've told that story so many times because there's three other witnesses. And that I have to tell people that. In my dad's death, that's information about our reality. And that blows my mind. And, you know, I don't think people are going to be like, because, you know, I got an entire career of trying to search for truth. And it's important that I tell, like, there was a crazy flash of light. Was that, what was that? Was that an angel? Was that a transfer of energy? Was that a glimpse into another dimension? Was that, it was why it's a gift. It was a blessing that maybe many people don't get to experience. And I got to experience it. So, like, and I'm coming through a filter of having, working at a strong relationship with you know, I guess I just picked, like, I guess I just picked them. Yeah. And I guess the next person could have a strong relationship with the next spiritual entity that they want to form a relationship with. And I, you know, that night, I was like, okay, I'm devout to you if you can just bail me out of this one, and I'm bailed out of this one. So anyways, you know, I'm seeing that experience through that filter, and it's like, it almost felt technical, like technical. Mm-hmm. So maybe it's just electricity. Maybe it was a thunderstorm outside, and there was just coincidence that, like, there's static in the air. We're in a hospital. There's electronics everywhere. Yeah. Maybe it was just some random, you know, a total scientific explanation for it. And I can accept that, too. I think that's a crazy coincidence. And then if I got to experience that coincidence, then I think that's something to experience. But spiritually speaking, I was just like, okay, what's this now? Like, and again, always trying to be a seeker kind of thing. It's just like I've sat, I can't not think of that in a day. And it's been 3 months of thinking of that every single day.
Yeah.
And continuing my spiritual practices that I'm connected to, and they're evolving. You know, the physical, being in my physical body and being grounded is, I always used to lean into the headiness of a spiritual practice, like prayer or meditation. And I'm actually finding now, in life, the groundedness of that spiritual practice is as valuable. Well, it's the balance, right? Like, it's so valuable to me. So, and aggressive stuff, fighting, like wrestling.
Didn't you just come from fighting?
A jiu-jitsu class. And my knees busted. It's not busted, but it's my body. Man, I'm 40 and I started, and I was just like, what am I doing? It's been 12 weeks and I have had a perpetual ass kicking for 3 months. And it's awesome. And I'm like, why do I love this? Why did I love getting choked out today 4 times? Why am I into this?
But it is
the groundedness.
I don't know if it's divine or the universe or the whatever. There is a clarity to the connection when your mind is in a certain space, right? I love riding my motorcycle. I don't just love riding my motorcycle because I can go fast when I want to go fast.
Yeah.
I love riding my motorcycle because when I'm on that motorcycle, my mind is not as cluttered as it is when I'm sitting on my couch. It's not as cluttered as it is when I'm doing nothing. There is a clarity to connection that comes from that type of experience.
It comes from risk.
Right.
Because you can't afford.
Right.
You know, you're tearing down with motorbikes.
That's just it.
You can't afford to have a wandering mind. It's almost like a little bit of a hack, like a meditative hack, where you're just like, I have to find a flow state. I have to be in this.
But I think that comes with the fighting sports as well.
Well, yeah. I mean, it mimics death, right? Like a tap out or a submission is essentially a maimed limb, a broken arm, a broken knee, a broken ankle, a busted neck, or a loss of choke outs, man. I was blown away what's legal. You can take your gi, you can take your belt and wrap it. I don't know
really?
Your belt, but you can take your gi, you wrap it around their throat and you yank back and you're choking them. And it's like, that's the sport. I was blown away. Some of that shit blows me away and it's deadly. It literally. But I think that's like the weird, I was just talking about it before I walked in the door here with another buddy, but I started jiu-jitsu 2 weeks before dad died. Walked in, and I've always, there's been this John Wayne, I think it was John Wayne, who just said that the good guys wear white and the bad guys wear black kind of thing.
Yeah.
You always know the good guy because he's the one in the white cowboy hat or whatever he said. Yeah. And that was always why I wore a white cowboy hat all the time. I'm a good guy. I'm one of the good guys. And I got into the gym and they were sizing me up for my gi and I was like, oh, I have the white one. And I put it on and I was just like, what's that? Chuck Klossman.
I wear the black hat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I haven't read that. I've read almost all of Klossman's stuff. And
it's a good one.
That. Yeah. So I put on this white gi and I was just like, this feels weird. It just didn't feel right. And I put on the black gi and it was like, I was like, whoa. And then 2 weeks of, you know, my dad being pumped, like you're fighting that. So the parallels of, and everybody says that goes into jiu-jitsu and I know it's cliche, but the parallels in life, so aligned. Yeah. You know, the sport is mimic state of grief right now and finding the beauty in it. And that's what the sport of jiu-jitsu is like, this state of suffering and it's art. It's,
I love that you call it art because I think that sometimes we obsess over the creative forms as one of the only ways to do art. but I love a great redone vintage motorcycle. I love a car show because I love the art of it. I love the care of it. And I think that we sometimes we just like give creativity all to music and art and pottery and all of those types of wonderful things that happen. And I love all of those things. But there's also beauty and artistic and creative parts to all of these types of things. And I think that, you know, if when you have the eye to look at all of that and you can have that appreciation, it makes life richer.
Oh, for sure. And you know, the thing about art, I feel art, I feel creativity, not necessarily if they're the one and the same, I don't know. Creativity is a direct pathway to the divine. Like another name for God is the creator. And what's another name for a creator but an artist? And I think that when you are living in the moment and just appreciating, you know, appreciating the task at hand and doing it to, what was the book about the motorcycle shop class, the Soulcraft? You probably have it on your shelf.
It's on the wall here somewhere.
I buy it every time I see it. And used bookstores, I always pick it up for $5. And I have like 3 or 4 on hand at the house because it was such an influential book in the fact that art is being in the moment. Art is being specific, and those really intrinsic qualities of just like focusing in on something. And I think the example used is you strip a bolt on your motorcycle and you could either go buy a new bolt or you can re-die. And it's an extreme example. You can re-die the original bolt and there is something that develops in your greater life, in your greater approach to life by choosing the road to re-die that original bolt. Yeah. It's artistic.
Well, and going back to, I think, where we both come from, which is the farm, there is an art and a beauty to care for the land, to take care of the machinery that you have. And I think there's a negative thing in the world when there's less of that. So for me, one thing why I love motorcycles is for me, and I'm nowhere near where I want to be on this, I wanted to take control over being able to fix one of my ways of transportation. There's no way I could fix my vehicle. I like, there's like 8 computers in the thing now. I couldn't fix it if I wanted to.
I love the idea of motorcycles. Yeah. I never really drove motorcycles and I'm like, I'm going to buy a motorcycle someday. So is it still as mechanical as it ever was?
No, they're more technical now. Like my dad just bought a Harley. It's got more things to it. If it breaks, you got to take it home. All of the motorcycles that I have are as old as I am. Literally, I like to say they rolled off the assembly line at the same time as I do, because all 3 of them are 1981s. One was a hand-me-down from my father that I learned to ride on, and I want to redo it and keep it up and bring it back to its basic original. Funny enough, I actually took the protector plate off the bottom and straw fell out of it. And we haven't had the farm in like 12 years. So it's been a while since
stubble field.
Exactly. You know. Yeah. It was either him or me. One of us did it to it, left it in there, but it was in there for 15 years until I took that stuff off.
Yeah.
And my plan is to redo that whole motorcycle and bring that back for multiple reasons in connection to it. But the reason that those bikes, which are now 40 years old, still run so well is that there's no computers on them. There's no extra, you know, we don't have to replace a microchip. Everything runs. It's an old school motor and they can all be done. And that's why there's so much beauty to redoing these vintage motorcycles. They last forever. Mm-hmm. You don't even have to take great care of them. Mm-hmm. Like there's probably 100 or so motorcycles sitting in old sheds in farms in Saskatchewan right now that would probably only take a couple hours of love and they would be back on the road.
So what you're saying is I should be rolling into yards with $500 cash.
Dude, I literally, my second week in Saskatchewan, my buddy came up to me here that I just met and he goes, oh, you love motorcycles. He's like, my dad's got one in a shed. He's like, how much should I sell it for? Huh. I said, like, I probably go for $500 to $700 on it. He's like, I'll sell for $500. You could probably get a bike. And I don't want to go too far in the weeds on this, but the insurance on bikes older than 1988 is like a tenth of what regular insurance is on a bike.
Oh, nice.
So you can actually a motorcycle in Saskatchewan for like $200 for an entire summer. I'm just saying.
Yeah, it's funny that you said art is farming. I've wanted to make a t-shirt for a decade that's just like farming is art.
Yeah.
and leave it at that. And that's the statement. Well, and you talk about even the birdcage. Your dad's probably just like totally in the moment, totally artistic, totally being as creative as him as an individual gets when he's in that flow state, in that zone with those birds.
As we go into the world, as we look at when, and I'm sure that we can find art in some of the technical things that happen now. I don't ever want to discount, like, I think whoever creates a video game is an incredible artist too. There's art to code as well. I think that people do that stuff too.
Oh, for sure.
I don't want to take away from that, but I do also think that there is a need for us to find those tactile ways to create.
Yeah.
You know, where, you know, you restrip a bolt and put her back in, where you, you know, re-weld a piece, where you, like, I just bought a mid-century modern fire pit that I am going to grind down, take pieces off of, and try to put back together just so that it kind of looks like it once did. I can't do exactly what it was, but I wanted to do that. I think there's, and I think that we need to make sure that we maintain that in our world. So much has been taken away by machines that I think there still is a need for us to find those spaces. And we're lucky that we live, in a community that I think that we're easily connected to nature and the outside. Like, we can drive for 15 minutes any direction, and we can go into a field But I remember when I lived in Toronto, like, it was like it felt like 2 hours until you actually saw a field or grass, like real grass.
Yeah.
And I think there's a loss in that.
I mean, that's the literal, I don't know, that is the factor as to what draws us to the farm right now, as much as anything, as much as family, is just like, I can see my son on my fire escape. Or I can see my son running on the vast front lawn. And if I didn't have my eyes on my son outside for seconds in the city, it'd be panic.
Yeah.
And man, he goes a while outside at the farm.
Yeah.
The 2-year-old with his 5-year-old cousin doing their thing, whatever that is. Yeah. We're like, oh, Where'd they go? And you're like, oh, you know, wherever. Oh, they're just on the side of the house looking at bugs. Okay, that's fine. And that's how I was raised. I was running around at 3 and 4 years old outside. And boy, there's something to say about trying to emulate that for my son.
Yeah.
Regina's been good to me.
Well, they call it unrestricted play.
Yeah, it's great.
The necessity for unrestricted play. I think...
Yeah. And then just throw the horses on top of that.
Yeah.
Like, did I ever take for granted. Yeah. Just what was just there, how I had fun.
Oh, dude, I apologize frequently to my parents for the amount of times I was like, can we go into town to a fast food restaurant when it comes to meals? Because, like, we were purebred Angus farm. Just the best steaks you would ever have in your life.
Every
and I would
night.
Be like, can we have McDonald's?
I know.
And we would trade, half a steer for like a couple of pigs. And so we would have, the best bacon, the best meat, the best, we'd have chicken. So we'd have the best eggs, the best chicken, all of it. And I'd be like, can we go to McDonald's? Like, why can't we go to McDonald's more often? Like, it's crazy to think about that now, that I would give anything to have the freezer my parents had.
And my mom made 3 big meals every single day, and I never made a school lunch, which is crazy. That also, I was up at 5:30 and did 2 hours of chores outside every winter before school and 3 hours after school, and that was my life, was PMU. like, we were talking about the farms that we had. I never even mentioned PMU, which was like, it dictated over a decade of her life. Pregnant mare urine.
Okay.
Yep. Just like a dairy operation, but they collect the urine from pregnant horses, and we would collect the urine, and the pharmaceutical company from Brandon would pick it up, and they would extract estrogen, and they'd make menopausal pills and birth control. That was like my family's income for on top of the cows, and my dad was there. My mom and dad were just always doing something. It's great.
Well, my dad was the same. He was the AI guy, one of the AI guys for Central Alberta for quite a while.
Oh yeah, there you go. Oh, yeah. There you go.
Yeah. So he did that for quite a bit. I used to love the old AI tank because I thought it looked like the engine from Back to the Future 2.
Oh.
And he would say, "Stop, stop opening that because that could be very expensive. Yeah. I didn't have no understanding when it was in that tank.
We never had AI. We never did.
No.
Artificial insemination.
Yeah. Not artificial intelligence. Yeah. AI has changed differently, but for us it was artificial insemination.
Artificial insemination.
Yeah. So we never used it much from our farm, but Dad did it for other farms.
Oh yeah, lots of guys. Yeah, for sure. Lots of guys do. But I never made a school lunch. It's crazy. It's crazy to think about that. And my breakfast, my mom would make, every once in a while, she'd make apple crisp at 5 o'clock in the morning. And we got to have it with as much ice cream as we wanted at 5:30 in the morning. Going out to the winter to do the barn chores. And we got to eat apple crisp in the morning. It was awesome. And then supper every night, like meat, and potatoes, and fresh garden vegetables, preservatives, just like, damn.
Well, and
that's good. That's good living. That's crazy.
And that's another one. The ability to walk outside and literally pick from the vine.
Yeah.
Corn, peas.
Oh, I know.
Carrots pulled right out of the ground.
I know.
Like I've never been a fan of cooked carrots because I was spoiled with the fact that I literally used to just walk outside, pull one out of the ground, wash off with a garden hose for 2 seconds and eat it.
We started watching Alone. I don't know what TV company makes. Maybe it's History Channel or but it's Alone and it's it's a competitive nature. And I think 9 or whatever individuals need to rough it off the land in these destitute areas. I think season 7 was Reindeer Lake in northern Saskatchewan. They're all over the world.
Yeah.
It's crazy. And they have to film themselves on top of surviving the elements. And they're flirting with death every episode. It's insane. This one guy comes across a pack of a patch of wild raspberries, right? And he's freaking out. He's like, Oh my God, this sustenance. Like I am set because he found some raspberries. I'm like, bro, the raspberry patch, and I literally, after seeing that episode, and it was right when my dad died, just sat in the raspberry patch and just picked raspberries. Yeah. And every raspberry is like, I'd look at it and I'm like, wow, this costs 50 cents at Safeway.
Yeah.
This big bastard costs 50, what is it? Like you get 12 raspberries for $6, man. It's nuts.
I know.
And I'm just looking at these and then I put it in my mouth. I'm like, holy shit, I just ate this. Beautiful raspberry. And it's stupid that it's a raspberry, but it was just like that thing where I'm like, it's true sustenance. It is from the land. There's a gift in everything. And damn, I'm into raspberries these days. And the fridge is still frozen raspberry. Vanilla ice cream. And
it's the best. It was the same way. Saskatoons and raspberries were the two that we had a lot of at the farm. And I just loved picking them. There was a golf course out by Round Hill that, or Roseland. We used to have the biggest Saskatoons I've ever seen in my life. I'd go with that every single time just because I wanted to eat the Saskatoons.
Always. Yeah. And it's so meditative too. When weeding the garden becomes art. It's when you're totally in the moment of weeding a garden and you look back on it, you're like, damn, this thing looks amazing. Well, that's art, baby.
Yeah. Sometimes I think people are looking for that moment in so many things that I just go, it's right in front of you.
Yeah, well, that's all of us, right?
Right. I'm the same way too. It's like I try everything just to give it a shot. Want to see what it's like.
Yeah.
But then I go, you know what? That simple meditation is right in front of me and literally taking care of my backyard.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you do a more traditional meditative practice?
No, I have done it in the past. I don't do it regularly.
Yeah.
I struggle with the ability to sit still.
Yeah.
Like as I find, as we were talking earlier, things that like riding the motorcycle, stand up paddleboarding is one that I love, riding my bicycle. I find those things are easier for me to get into that sort of meditative space than doing an actual meditative practice because it's hard for me to settle my mind.
Yeah. Yeah. I find it different. Find it a different practice than the next thing that provides a...
You meditate regularly?
No, not regularly. But I mean, when I do intentionally.
Yeah.
I always think you can... I mean, regularly, sure. Every few days, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just... it's this weird... It's a weird spiritual journey. Like... You learn things, your body. I actually brought you a gift, and it's my sister's book. What?
Oh,
yeah,
wow.
Totally.
Your sister has a book?
My sister has a book. It's called The Mind Body Way. And it's about just this, being embodied and letting your body give you the answers. And
wow.
For me, it comes from meditation and other things, like not just, but when you sit there with whatever discomfort you have, you receive this weird insight. That's, you know, it's a nice segue to give you that, but it's,
yeah, thank you.
It is sort of the central theme to what she does. All my siblings are trips. Like,
are you the
own.
Oldest, youngest?
I'm the eldest of four.
You're the eldest of four. Okay.
Of four.
Yeah. So I'm the top middle of four.
Okay.
Yeah. So I've got an older sister, I got a younger sister, and a fairly younger brother. Like,
okay.
It's 9 years between me and my brother. And we all had starkly different experiences.
Did you have a religious like upbringing?
No, we were a weddings and funerals kind of a family on that. But my parents are religious. My dad talks of God fairly frequently, more than he used to.
Mm-hmm.
But we weren't religious. We were united, as you know, that was our church when anything had happened. But we didn't go regularly, and we didn't talk about it regularly. And religion for me has been a search for a very, very long time. Because I didn't have any sort of basis of it until I was in my teens.
Yeah.
Like, just none. Like, and then I fell in with the Mormons, actually, in high school. A couple of my really close friends were Mormons, so I used to go to the Mormon youth group quite regularly with them.
Yeah.
And didn't really understand the basis of the religion itself, but loved the community of it. So that was really fun. It was really fun to be a part of. I remember that.
Yeah.
I have a lot of respect for Mormons,
okay.
At least the Mormons that I was around. You know, I think there is beauty in the service. There's a lot of talk of service in that.
Yeah.
I think there is parts of their beliefs I find to be a bit too wild and crazy for me, but
that's the thing about religion. It's just like, for those that take it all and are just like, no, I'm in on this, you know, I think that's a little bit naive.
Yeah.
You gotta have I always pray for the power of discernment to be, you know, what is true and what is not true, what is bullshit and what is a seed of truth, and how can I lean into that seed of truth. And religion offers both of those.
Yeah, absolutely does,
right? And it's a good entry point, but you know, I think it's actually kind of dangerous when folks just, that's not just the entry point, but that's where it sits. It's static in your belief system for as long as you are just, I don't want to sound judgmental at all of people that don't search for other answers, because that's just a personality thing with me. But it's also healthy to do.
I think, to me, a lot of, when it comes to religion, I've read a lot about religion, listened to a lot, watched a lot, because I have always kind of been searching for what answers are without anything firmly locked in, is you've got to look at the context of the time. You've got to understand that even it, divinely inspired or not, you know, we don't have an understanding of how exactly that voice spoke to those people and how they interpreted what they wrote down, who wrote what it was edited over time. Like there's a lot never been presented to us, what was taken out in several centuries past, the different versions of the Bible, the different interpretations, the different the translators that took it from, you know, all of the different languages. There's so much that's been changed in there that to take every single word from a face value is just not even possible. But as you said, there is incredible seeds of truth. I have found that some of the best and greatest people in my life have been very religious people who are very open-minded and non-judgmental people as well.
Mm-hmm.
Like some of the kindest, as I said, like my friends who were Mormon that I knew from that time were some of the kindest, most caring, most loving people.
Mm-hmm.
One of the biggest family, I think they had 9 kids. And they had experienced an incredible amount of loss in a very short period of time. The father passed away. 2 of the sons have passed away.
Mm.
Over time, and have still stayed very faithful and still stayed incredibly wonderful and connected family. So there is so much beauty in a religion. If you, I feel like if you don't get overly connected or overly connected to literal, to taking so much of it incredibly literally, because it can't be taken literally because it was written in a different time where people had absolutely completely different concepts of even some things. Like, that's where it becomes hard.
Yeah, I find it, for me in my life, the Bible specifically, I just use it as a guidepost. Mm-hmm. And it is, and, you know, the more you get into it, the more it provides this mystery and this riddle and this, it's wild. It's a wild, the story, there's a reason that this, it's sticking around, man, because from top to bottom, the story is wild. And it's a good story, like for the sake of strictly a story. It's mind-blowing. And the crazy shit that happens, and that's not even getting into Revelations. You read Revelations, it's wild. So how can, and whether it's fear propaganda or whether there is truth in it or whether it is, I don't know. All I know is that I feel something when I look for some guidance. And that's what's presented. I'm like, damn, like I'm willing to look through the interpretation as to how I can move forward in good in my life. And it's a healthy little compass for me.
And I think, while I think you speak to it, that there's a reason the book's been around for that long, is because I think everything can be drawn out of it.
Oh, it's crazy shit happens in it, man.
Yeah. Like, but but I mean, if you are looking for what you need, it's there. It's there.
Yeah. Yeah. I like to recognize that we make pat as our survival, our evolution is, you know, hinged on the fact that we have this ability to recognize patterns.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been fascinated by that ability. And I, again, whether it's a coincidence of light flashing over my dad's body or whether it's the next thing. It's just like,
well, I think for me, we didn't survive and we didn't become what we are as a humanity out of, in my opinion, intelligence or out of strength. We came out of it because of community and something more. And we don't know what that something more is.
You mean like from primitive state
to... From primitive state to becoming the dominant life form on this planet.
Oh, yeah, aliens, man.
Well, I think that might have been in there too. Hey, that might have been in there too.
Freaking aliens, man.
Well, but it might have been magic mushrooms. Monkeys eating magic mushrooms.
I like that theory. Yeah. Who knows?
Yeah.
Who knows?
But I think, to me, I don't think it was our intelligence that did it. I don't think it was our strength that did it, because there was much stronger animals in many forms. I think it was our community.
Yeah, well,
I think it was
many factors.
Right.
It was a weird mixture of chance and many, many factors, obviously.
And there could be an Indian in there.
And it could be a little alien. Who knows? I don't know. I kind of think all this alien stuff is bullshit right now. That's what I think. But we don't have to get into that.
Well, I think a lot of what's going on alien stuff is bullshit. But I do think there's no way there's not life on other planets.
Okay, I think that what we're being told is some kind of disclosure is bullshit.
Yeah.
That's exactly what I think. I'm like, come on.
I agree.
Everybody has their aliens that they're putting on display now, and there's documents. Come on. Like, what are you going to do to us next for us to be so distracted? And you know what? People aren't distracted. People are like, oh, there's aliens and nobody gives a shit. No, it's because nobody gives a shit.
No.
Because it's a distraction. Because
we've looked through it and we know that it's all a distraction.
I've earlier in the podcast, there was this contact with this thing, this entity, mm-hmm. that was some kind of multidimensional fuckery. Like, I don't know what that was. Right. Yeah. And maybe that's, you know, aliens. Sure. There's dimensions, there's universes, and there's something else. You call it what you want, angels, like whatever. There's something else, but it's not, there's flying saucers there right now. That's your shit that you made up that you're putting under our nose so you could use it on other countries because we're at war.
Right.
That's what that is.
Well, and I think there's people needing something like that to cling on to. And I think that's, I don't think we're in the space to do it. The fact that Trump declassified all of the Area 51 stuff in order to have to let people look through it, should tell you enough about the intentions of why this stuff is happening, because that's all he does.
But maybe
he's
that's
nothing
real.
But show maybe and distraction.
Maybe those were aliens. Like that's what I'm saying. Maybe
it could have been.
I'm just saying right now, the story's bullshit.
Oh yeah, I know that one. That with the bodies and the that one's complete bullshit.
My wife said it was cake. And then then the meme came out that it was cake.
Oh, that's
she
hilarious.
Was like, no way. Like,
Stupidest reality show on earth, by the way. Do you ever see that Is It Cake reality show that went on for a little bit?
No.
I saw a clip of it. I never watched it.
I go down the rabbit hole on my Instagram reels and I get sucked in by the Is It Cake trends too sometimes. Like, oh, no shit. That's pretty good.
Well done. Yeah.
Well done. That is cake, hey?
Okay. Well, we're at over an hour, and I don't want to run out of battery or run out of space in the saving, but I do want to touch on a couple of things before we wrap this up. First off, your wife, Belle Plaine.
Oh, she's the best.
She's an incredible musician in her own right. You play with her as a pair. You play in her band as well.
No longer. I got fired.
What?
It's easier to be a dad than be a bass player, and it's easier to have a dad around than hiring. It's easier to hire a bass player than hire a bass.
So it sounds like you got promoted.
I got promoted to dad. I don't have to be in the road band anymore. Yeah, we all, I'm always there for her. I always like to jump on stage, and you know, if a week comes where she's like, oh, I got these dates and can you do them? And I do them. Yeah. And it's super fun. And my mom comes in and helps out, but it's our system right now is, well, you know, when we're on stage together, honestly, that's one paycheck. And when we're going in different directions, that's two paychecks. Mm-hmm. And we have to just sort of like go back to old school. And she was always did Belle Plaine and I always did Blake Berglund. And it's feels very aligned to just sort of steer our own ships right now. And then we have a joint thing that we're doing and announcing right away that is more business minded. It's not as performance minded, but it's more business stuff.
Well, that's another thing. You've always got lots of projects going. What's Little Jack Films? How are you involved in that?
Well, he's a very elusive and mysterious entity. I don't know if I'm comfortable speaking about
him. Okay, no worries.
Little Jack, he's a dude that has a camera around all the time.
Yeah.
And chooses who he wants to have a camera around and is devout to that person. And he makes art for art's sake.
Huh?
And he's just getting better and better and better. And he always has a project on the go. And he just put out a Dear TV thing. It's a 20-minute, he calls it a visual EP.
Okay.
And it's a meditative experience with five original songs by Saskatchewan artists. And it's brilliantly edited and put together. And that's what he does. He makes these little short films. And I saw it and I was just like, I mean, the story with Little Jack is he made a music video for a band called, it was pre-local group and pre-Ellen Fraze, and In With The Old was their name. And I saw 10 seconds of it. And it was so good that I messaged Jackson, the one member of the band. I was like, who did this? He's like, oh, this is Little Jack Films. I said, give me his number. And he's like, oh, okay. Yeah. He gave me his number and I called him and he agreed to 9 music videos within 10 minutes of me first seeing his work for the first time.
Wow.
And we did 8 of them and we have one more that we're like, got to finish that 9th music video that we said we were going to do. And we've done other music videos. We've done dozens of music stuff together, but there's one missing piece to the Realms puzzle and it's because Little Jack and I didn't finish. We had a video for every song.
Yeah.
Except for Jesus and a Backbeat. And we're like, oh, we gotta. So maybe when I release that album as a vinyl, we'll pick up the storyline and get the last music video out.
And you guys did it. I don't know if it's Little Jack Films, but you guys did a documentary on your life as well and show?
Oh man, I don't know. Not specifically, but always. There's always me talking to the frigging camera and him collecting. Yeah. I know what you're talking about.
You were talking about Living From Home. Yeah.
Living From Home. Yeah, that was awesome. That was a streaming event that we tried to put together, and it turned out really well. It was Little Jack in our space in a very intimate portrayal of my marriage and our family life. And there was some live performance, live acoustic stuff that we did in the living room. And there was also, he followed us around in studio for the recording of 2 songs. We did We redid Dolly Parton's 9 to 5, and nice. We redid Flowers on the Wall.
Classic.
Yeah.
And we sold online tickets, and it was a streaming event, and it was just a little hit for us. Like it's been, and it's never been shown or seen by anybody other than that one night that
I know
it streamed.
I tried to find it.
I want to bring it to little theaters. Like it's a 75 minute, maybe it's 90. I don't think it's that long. I think it's about 75 minute. Really well put together, really oversight with lots of great tunes and insight into the studio process and a lot of like fun little stuff in my marriage. We're always kind of ragging on each other and loving each other. And it's
that's
fun.
My question. Why can't we not? But the video, this exists. Like it didn't just happen and go into the ether. So it exists somewhere.
It's a substantial piece of content that we have that we have and released publicly.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we're already working on Living From Home too. It's already nice. It's already, and we will probably do another streaming event because it just kind of playing in that area of video and film, like it's just like another extension of the songs. I love making music videos. I love making documentaries. I love working with Little Jack. There's an artist out of Rokenville right now. I'm all in on Lachlan Neville. I name drop him like crazy because he's so good. He's writing lyrics that like, it's not hyperbole. People like Guy Clark would be like, that's a great lyric. And Townes Van Zandt are like, that sounds like something as strong as I would write. Like it's great. And I get to collaborate with Little Jack and Lachlan and put them in the same room together and produce stuff. So like my career direction right now is really taking on a collaborative and production and business sort of, and I got all these songs and I got a whole bunch of shows coming up. So and I'm writing a ton of Substack stuff.
Yeah. You're a busy man.
It's awesome.
Yeah. I was reading the Substack earlier and going back to your wife, do you feel like, because I read the one about the kind of the three phases of your life and your career. And do you feel like meeting her was the catalyst of one of those? Or was it you had come to a place and then she came along? Like when we talk about, things being like the universe providing in it, essentially things coming into your life when they're supposed to come in. Did you find yourself in a new place and then she came into your life, or did she come into your life and led to a new place?
Oh, she came in my life in an extremely chaotic place in my, where I was in life. And hers was similarly, I can't speak for her, but like it was a lot, there was a lot going on in our lives when we met. And that's the origin story. It was hot, man. It was awesome. And it was very difficult. And, if it would have been easier to have a strong marriage and a strong relationship, I'd say, this was, the universe provides. Hmm. But it is one of the most difficult things that I've ever done, is have a strong, happy marriage and relationship. And we work hard at it, and it's very fulfilling. And we just came into each other's lives, and we just didn't, for whatever reason, didn't call it off when it probably would have made sense. And it did make sense in other relationships in similar, difficulties, and we didn't. And a lot of it was this combination of we jumped into studio together and we were professionals together and we just kind of jumped in the deep end professionally, and that influenced it. We didn't want to throw that away, and that also is what gave us the desire. And there was just like raw love, I just love her to the moon and back, and to see her as a mother of my son is just like, it blows my mind. And it's made me closer to my mom, and she's just revered in my family. I mean, Melanie's revered in our community. She is she's a stand-up woman. It's amazing. I'm very blessed and lucky to be the father of her son. That's crazy. And it's awesome.
That's great. All right. So just to wrap everything up, you did mention that you're out on tour, and most of the shows on your tour should come up, should happen after this podcast comes out. So what do you got coming up?
Well, so the tour is called Talking to Farmers.
Yeah.
And I've got some feedback from people that be like, well, is he going to sing any songs? I was like, oh, damn. I wonder if people, and I have been talking a lot. I've been doing these check-in with the basses on my Substack and little podcast-esque and, you know, putting some ideas out there. And yeah. So we'll see how the turnout is. I put in the releases like, a bunch of new songs. And so I'm playing it. It's a show. Lots of music. Good opening acts right through the whole thing. Brad Proudlove, Lachlan Neville's opening it up some. Damn Coyote Chris, buddy of mine up from outside of Grand Prairie-esque. Do some songwriter circles. So originally I was like, oh well, this is kind of the branding, the tour branding for the unforeseeable future. Where it's just like it's talk, because that's what it is. That's I'm out playing rural Saskatchewan, rural Manitoba, rural Alberta, and it's farmers that are coming out and we're hanging out at the merch booth and I get to listen. And that is so rewarding to have agriculture conversations with my fan base. So it was like tongue in cheek. I was like, hey, talking to farmers, I should make that the name of the tour. And I, as long as people aren't thinking, oh, I wonder if he's ever going to sing his songs. And then, you know, what if I don't? What if tough shit? What if tonight I'm talking? Then, you know, that might be what it is. But I have lots of new songs that I want to play for people. And they're pretty funny.
Yeah.
There's, I kind of go through periods of writing. Well, and they're pretty serious too. It's all over the board, but like, you know, you tap into different muses and a humor and playfulness has been a really healing quality for me that I've leaned into in the creation of this record and just kind of the direction things are headed. I like humor right now, and you can get away with saying some potent shit if you can make it funny.
Absolutely.
And that's what the punches are going to be thrown.
Spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down.
Yeah. The punches are going to be thrown on this tour and this upcoming record. And I feel I'm in a place of, man, spiritually, like I got what I believe in. I got my God and I kind of makes me brave, makes me feel genuinely courageous. Makes me feel like I'm going to
do my thing in yourself.
Yeah. I definitely feel confident in myself these days. And there's a lot of times in life where I don't, and I struggle just like anybody else. But these days, the shit that's going on and coming out on the other side of it, it's almost cliche, but it does feel like, you know, feels like a little rebirth. It feels like a little bit of a comeback. Like I've been sort of not stagnant, but just not as active as I have always been since I was 18 years old and I'm 40. And then there's that. It's like, well, this is how I'm going to do it for the next however long, and I'm just showing up with an acoustic guitar and letting her rip, baby.
What do you think of 40?
Oh, it's like being the young one in a new group.
Yeah,
I feel young again.
Yeah,
I thought I struggled leading into it, genuinely struggled leading into it, and then I turned 40 and I had this amazing surprise party that Melanie threw for me, and I felt loved. And I was just like, wow, I'm loved and I'm providing something. And this is an age that many people don't get to see. And let's go. I'm strong now to do some crazy shit. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I felt the same.
Yeah.
When going into it, it was stressful. And then coming through it and now a couple years into it, I go, oh man, I like this. Like it's the beginning of the back half.
Yeah.
You know, like it's not the end of anything. It is the beginning of the back half.
And it's like the leveraging of everything that I've accumulated, every bit of knowledge, every bit of self-understanding. And it's to like leverage into the next half where it's like there's some bigger challenges ahead and I want to go towards them. Yeah. Like, let's go. Yeah. So yeah, I like 40.
Yeah. So every time I wrap this up, I just ask a couple of questions. The first one is there a record that you recommend that everybody give a listen to? Whether it's something that you've loved for life or somebody you've got coming up?
I have to honor the first record that popped in my head, and it's Terminal Romance by Matt Maes.
Yeah?
That dude, man.
That's a great one.
That is a great record.
Yeah.
Like, that was when you said, is there a record that, that was the first one. I'm like, damn, that's a hot record. It's so good. The songwriting, I'm just I've always wanted Matt Maes to produce a record with. I'd like to do a record with him.
That would be amazing.
It'd be awesome. I saw him at Calgary Folk Fest this summer, and he was just, he's...
Well, he came out and did that there in Moose Jaw.
Last year.
Homestand.
Crushed it, man. They're amazing. That Homestand Festival, Melanie was supposed to play it this year. It didn't line up. They were just like, here, well, we're going to treat you like one of the artists that's playing it. And they just treated us like gold.
They were,
And it
they
was
were...
so organized. And the tone, the field, being in the baseball field.
Yeah, I missed it this year, but I went last year for the Matt Mays show. Great bunch of people, just wonderful down-to-earth people, those the River Street Promotions that put it together.
Yeah.
And Matt Mays just crushed it.
It's probably been
12 years ago. I had to pick him up from the airport. We're doing an interview with him, and then he was going to drop him off at the venue. He played in Medicine Hat.
And I played, I was at that show at the college. He played a couple times. No, he played at that weird bar just off the
highway.
Yeah, I was there. He was wearing like...
Yeah, comes out in an Elvis suit.
Yeah, in a white Elvis suit.
White Elvis suit.
Okay, I was there.
So, yeah, picked him up.
Medicine Hat, that's right.
Yeah.
I got stolen with him that night. It was awesome.
It was an incredible show.
Yeah.
I pick him up in the car, man. He's the chillest dude
Super chill.
I've ever met. Just the nicest guy. Gave him the ride to the station. We did the interview. Super chill dude. And he cracks one joke in the whole time. And he goes, but then I go to that show that night, comes out on stage in that Elvis suit, and just puts on a rock show from like start to finish nonstop.
That was promoting the Terminal Romance.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure.
Yeah. And that was one great record. Incredible show. He's such a good showman. He's so much fun.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I can't remember what that bar was called. I don't know. Anyway, the Hat was a great time. Matt Mays was one of my favorites. And he did that again here out there at the Ball Diamonds, where, you know, not every one of his records is such balls to the wall rock and roll. But when he puts on a show, he puts on a hell of a show.
Yeah.
And he did something really, really cool there, because one of the guys from River Street Promotions, his son was in School of Rock. Or a different school I think it was a school program there in Moose Jaw. Matt Mays brought the school, the kids up to perform on a song with him.
Yeah, he's awesome.
He's just
an awesome dude. I know. That stuff goes a long ways in
miles
in who I want to invest in.
Yeah.
And whether it's a ticket or whether it's t-shirt or whether it's just wanting to like support the show, you know, I'm not going to slander any any artist, but I've had shows with some guys that, you know, they're known to be dicks and they delivered. Like, it's just like, wow, unbelievable. But yeah. And you know what? I never got to meet the Hip, and I always thought like, damn, just meeting Gord Downie, all the people that were blessed to have him in their life. I just think it's sort of the same, you know, not to put Matt Mays and Gord Downie on the same level, but there's this tone to being chill.
Yeah.
There's this thing about chillness that you want to be around it.
I'll tell you right now, one of the luckiest things I ever got to do was meet Gord Downie.
That's crazy.
And I didn't get to meet him on a Tragically Hip tour, but he was doing a solo tour, and he popped by Sonic in Edmonton to do an interview. I didn't do the interview, but we got a little meet and greet with him, and it was literally, I think, three of us that were in there, like me and Jason Manning, who was the music director and the record rep, in a room with Gord Downie. And it was like maybe 5-10 minutes, but like, it couldn't have been more Canadian if he rode in on a moose.
Yeah.
He literally was in jeans and a jean jacket and a t-shirt and a toque, holding a Tim Hortons, and he's
Gord Downie.
So just, you know, you see that personality that comes out on the stage, but when you're with him and you're standing next to him and you're so like nervous, even though you have no reason to be, because he's incredibly chill and calm and kind and generous in a way, like, you know, it didn't feel like he was in a rush or like he had to get out of the room. And I've been in those spaces where they're just like, this is the last place they want to be, and then he might have in his head been that way, who knows.
Yeah.
That never came off. He just was chill and cool and kind, and it wasn't a long conversation, but I'm so grateful that I got that moment with him. And he was so nice. He just really was. He was just what you would always have hoped him to be.
Yeah.
And Yeah, and like there's definitely rock stars on my list that I'm like, I hope I get to do a meet and greet with, but I'm nervous, you know. But with him, he was exactly what you would want him to be.
Yeah.
And it was so great.
Jason Plum, who's in a band, the Waltons, and Jason has a bunch of his own stuff. Yeah, and he and I are, you know, we see each other 3 times a week. He has a new little baby, so our kids are buds, which is weird because he's 55 today. It's awesome. But Jason's stories, like the hip enticed them, the Waltons, to get to Toronto. Yeah. And I don't want to tell Jason's stories, but I can't not tell this. And, you know, I believe my dates are right, but Gord was at... in New Orleans, they were working on Road Apples, and Jason Plum receives a postcard from Gord, you know, hey man, thinking of you. Like, who does that? He has postcards.
Do you ever hear Rick Mercer's story about Gord Downie?
No.
About how Gord Downie literally phoned his father to ask Rick Mercer's father about one of, like, a bit of his heritage. I can't tell the story well. If you ever get a chance, watch the clip, because it is just another beautiful Gord Downie moment that you just go, wow. And like, I'm really grateful that like one of my first big concert experiences is Tragically Hip. It was another roadside attraction, 1997.
Dude.
Like, it was just one of the best shows I've ever seen in my life. It was kind of annoying that that was like the second show I ever saw. And like, it's been hard to top in life was seeing him do his thing.
Yeah.
But he's just so, he's so incredible.
Yeah.
I've been really lucky to see him and to see Leonard Cohen live. Those were the two for me, like, that just had to happen.
Yeah.
And I also got to meet Leonard Cohen as well. Crazy. On the street, going to the drugstore, just ran into him on the street.
What city?
In Denver.
In Denver.
And I'd driven to Denver to see him live.
Oh, yeah?
I wanted to see him at Red Rocks. I thought, because it was his second last tour, and I was pretty sure, like, like he doesn't have too many in him, and it was his second last tour, so I was like, I could go to the Edmonton show, or I could go to Red Rocks and see him there.
Yeah.
And I did that, and then we ended up, the show got postponed for 2 days because of rain, because it's an open amphitheater. And we didn't have any money because it was like radio. I was in Medicine Hat at the time. I had no money. So we like had to change hotels to divier place and like literally like had nothing for the 2 days. But out of that happening on the day in the middle, he had to stay 2 extra days. I ran into him running to the drugstore. And he was kind and cordial. And as I said, like he was clearly headed somewhere, but he was very giving. Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah. And there was no crowd around him. Nobody knew who he was. I didn't even notice him right away. My friend noticed him right away.
Yeah.
And like, she was like, oh my God, it's Leonard Cohen. And I said, oh my God, it is Leonard Cohen. And I said, oh, Mr. Cohen, I'm a big fan. We're here for your show. I was like, and this is the line that I love so much of this interaction. I said, I'm really excited for the show. All the reviews say that it's amazing. I don't know why that's what came out of my mouth, but that's what did. I was super nervous. And he goes, yeah, people seem to like it.
Yeah, nice.
Which you're like, that is such a Leonard Cohen line. Yeah. And then the interaction ended. We took a photo together and the interaction ended with, he goes, I like your hat. And I said, I like yours too. Because of course he's in a fedora and a suit in the middle of the afternoon in Denver heading to the drugstore to pick up whatever medication he needs because he was probably a 75-year-old man at the time.
By himself.
By himself.
Crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. That's
a pretty good story.
Yeah, it was crazy. So I'm very grateful that I got to meet those two gentlemen in my life because they were both what I had hoped that they would be.
Yeah.
But yeah. Next question. Book you would recommend.
I still want to talk about Gord Downie. Never Ending Moment. Is that the name of it? The Barclay? The Never Ending Moment.
The
biography on the hip. I think that's what it's called. The Never Ending Moment. Yeah.
If you On a Cold Road, like literally was one of the books that inspired my life. Have you ever read that?
No, I haven't.
So it's the book by Dave Bedini of the Rio Statics talking about touring with the hip.
Oh, really?
Across Canada. Huh. If you have not read that, you need to read that book.
Yeah.
It is, and I mean, you will identify with so much because you've toured, and it's about what it's like to tour Canada. The Canada is a weird space, like to do a cross Canada tour.
Were they from Dublin?
No, no, they're Canadian. Rio Statics.
Well, yeah. Who am I thinking? I'm thinking of some. Who's the Irish band that used to tour with the Hip? I thought they're from Ireland. Okay, anyways.
Yeah, the Rio Statics. Yeah, Dave Bedini is also an incredible writer. He writes about baseball and hockey. He's got great books. He's a very accomplished author now. Probably more, like, I don't think the Rio Statics have put out a record in quite a bit. Yeah. They did an incredible children's record, by the way, too. If you ever get a chance, it's like Harmelodia, the story of Harmelodia.
Okay.
It's one, because you've got a kid. Yeah. I highly recommend giving a listen to the story of Harmelodia.
Well, that Bare Naked Ladies kids record is pretty smart.
Is it really?
Oh, yeah, it's pretty smart. I mean, I'm not, you know.
This one's a little bit different. I'll tell you, it's like they create a whole sort of fantasy world, and it's got a bit of a Beatles-esque kind of feel to it.
Yeah.
But I highly recommend that one. But On a Cold Road, if you get a chance, I recommend that you give that a read. It's a beautiful book about touring Canada and about being on that Hip tour.
Crazy.
And I read it when I was probably 16 or 17, and it was one of those books that just, like, yeah, like, I want to be a part of this. Like, I don't know how, because I suck at playing things, but, like, I want to be a part of this.
Yeah.
So I highly recommend that. Yeah. So book recommendation then would be,
I believe it's called The Never Ending Present to the Never Ending Moment. I feel terrible that I'm not remembering. It's by Michael Barclay, and it's just a story about the Tragically Hip, and it's just so well written and so well researched. And yeah, it was.
Have you seen we talk about Hip all day because I'm a big fan. Have you seen the documentary about Bob Cajun?
Yeah.
In Bob Cajun?
Oh, yeah.
So good. So good.
Man, I couldn't watch Long Time Running for years. Yeah. I put it on not that long ago, like about a year ago or 2 years ago, for the first time, and just, like, pulled out the hide of it. I'm like, okay, tonight I'm going to cry. I bawled through the whole thing.
What was it called again? Hex and Kettle? The VHS? I have the VHS of Hex and Kettle.
Oh, yeah.
But I watched it on YouTube. And one thing that I love about the Tragically Hip, and...
Is that the Fully Completely European?
The Fully Completely Another Roadside Attraction.
Yeah.
The first Another Roadside Attraction, not the one that I actually saw, but it was a document of the first Roadside Attraction. But what I love about them, because both the Bob Cajun film and in Hex and Kettle, they do such an incredible job of not just highlighting the band, but everybody involved in it. They just show so much love to the crew.
The crew, yeah.
And everybody involved in making those shows happen. And I just, that's such a... Such a Gord Downie thing, such a Tragically Hip thing, such a Canadian thing to do.
Like, I didn't realize how Gord's death affected me.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it was the first celebrity that I was just like totally shook. Totally, totally shook.
But when we talk about beautiful things out of terrible things and moments that change your life, what a moment for Canada. That last show that was broadcast across the entire country and watched by so many.
It's culturally surreal.
We were gifted, if anything, we were gifted an ability to say goodbye.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Which you don't get with every artist.
Yeah.
We were given that ability to, and as I said, like, it's never fun to try to find a positive in such a terrible thing, but, like, we got that ability to have that last tour, and he did so incredible in such a, like, terrible time for him. I was, like, we were on a family vacation when that show happened, and we literally brought the laptop out, and me and my brother shared watching that together, and I'll never forget that.
Yeah.
Like, it was so important for us to see that show that we, you know, brought a laptop out, hooked it up. We watched that whole show. You know, the country watched that show and said goodbye to Gord because of how much he meant to the world.
And is there another... story that went that way in rock and roll? Like, sure, there were last shows before people passed, but not that story.
No,
not that, just embedded in our cultural significance. I'm fascinated with the search, you know. Maybe I'll write a book about this, but I'm fascinated with the search for the why, the resonating collective why. As to how you and I could do another 2 hours on this topic, right? And we're just, have we ever spoke about the Hip before? I don't know if we have.
No.
I don't think so. But, you know, it's the fucking Hip band. They're the greatest band of all time. No hyperbole again. Like, they're the best. And everybody that gets it, and people don't get it. And I'm always trying to spread the gospel. And I'm just like, no, like, you know. And it almost, you come up empty. Yeah. If you don't, and the live experience obviously was, my first concert again. Mm-hmm. Now, the first thing I ever heard live was The Gift Shop.
Wow.
So it was just like this surreal, and all of a sudden, a pendulum. Boom, in the whiteout lights, and like that was my first live concert experience. Wow. That is,
that's what
nothing's
I mean.
Top.
Like,
that.
That's what I mean. They for both of us, they set a bar nothing that is almost that impossible moment, to come anywhere near. Like, I was so lucky because I saw the Hip twice live, and then I saw Gord live twice on his own. But like the first time, nothing will top. Because I got him in the rant period, right? Where he would go off on the tangents. And he went through this whole tangent. Well, at the Big Valley Jamboree grounds in Camrose, Alberta, he did the whole tangent because somebody threw a shoe at the band. And he was like, the kind of person who would throw a shoe at a band is the kind of person that would kick a caribou. And he had all of these amazing off the top of his head references that I wish there was a recording, like the Killer Whale Tank.
There
like,
probably
I,
is
I hope
somewhere.
That I wish but like it was so that moment led to so many times where I just go like, you know, bring it back to you. The tour that you're going to do is going to have moments that people cannot get off a record, cannot get off of watching a video. It will only be for the people that are going to be in that room.
Yeah, that's the sport.
And that's the beauty of it. Yeah. But that's the fun. That's the beauty. That's the thing of like what makes live so exciting is that nothing will ever truly be like it was in that room then. And like we now have so many acts that people go to that they're trying to recapture the moments that they saw in their youth, but it's never going to be the same. Like it just, it really never is.
I would say fresh is fresh. Be fresh. Huh? Like there's still a live music experience, and you know, if you're a young artist, just be fresh. Just be you, and that is the ticket. That is the answer. Yeah. Just and be up unapologetically. Again, you know, not to bring it back to Matt Mays, but like there's just such this really profound growth as a songwriter in his catalog that resonates with me. So I'm a fan.
Yeah. Well, he is Station Out of Range is one that I listen to quite a bit from Matt Mays because my years and years and years in radio, I always bring that track back to me. But like, yeah, he's got such great stuff. The Hip.
But what about The Hip, man?
I could talk about The Hip for days. God. Like The Hip saved my life. Like,
oh, for sure.
I have a banner in my that talks about It's a Good Life If You Don't Weaken because that song literally was one of the songs in my darkest days that was there for me.
Yeah.
And then you go to like barroom rockers that they had in their first couple of records to the somber ones. And there is a life,
everything.
There is a lifespan in those records that other bands don't ever touch.
And as a super fan, there's a finite, they're releasing a bunch of new stuff and it's all great, but there's that finite collection that we were given that there's always something new. There's it's such a gift.
Well, and there's then songs. Like one thing that I love about the Tragically Hip is you have the ability, if you want to put the work in, to make the songs richer by understanding the things that he speaks about.
Yeah.
When you get to know the history of some of the references, there's you make the songs richer, and that any piece of art where you can do that is incredible, and they have so many of them. Because of Gord's writing.
Yeah.
And so there's so much there. Last question, because we're almost at 2 hours.
Amazing.
Which is the longest one I've ever done for this. But I love it. This has been a great conversation. Something that people should watch.
Something that people should watch? Oh, boy. Boy, I don't want to be stagnant on this. I know that I was quick with the album, but
that's okay. It's a podcast. I can edit out silences
forever.
What
comes to me again, and I was sort of hesitant. I'm like, do I want to be so this tone? But The Passion of the Christ is an amazing film.
Really?
It's an amazing
film. I've never watched it.
Film. The actors learned Hebrew and learned Arabic. Mm-hmm. Arabic, and And the story is profound. And it's just a great story. It all kind of all comes back to a story for me. And I maybe that's why I'm so attracted to my faith right now, is just like, it's just rooted in this story, this wonderful story.
So I really appreciate you coming in here today, having this conversation with me, being so honest and genuine with me, as you always have been. We've known each other for years, but never spoken this long.
This is awesome.
And man, I really appreciate it. So thank you very much, Blake. I Likewise. Really, really do, man. Thank you.
Thanks, brother.